This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK11. And by Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion, enabling Star Trek comm badge-like interactions with Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, smart objects, and much, much more. To find out more about Zoe, visit zoe.me/trekfm. That's xowi.me/trekfm. And also by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints, featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hi, this is Garrett Wong. I played Ensign Harry Kim on Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 119, Neutronic Wave Mode. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Armin Shimerman's new film project, Kate Mulgrew's memoir, and the election of J.G. Hertzler. We also preview two tracks from Five-Year Missions Year 3, and we answer some questions from the fleet. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek to discuss The Catwalk. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It's great to have you with me on the Ready Room this week. I would say long time no see. At least for you being on the Ready Room, but you know, you and I do two shows together every week, so.
This is true, Chris. I mean, we do see each other a lot, I think, during the week.
That's right. So I understand this weekend that you were very busy. I think you had a wedding to go to. Now, was that a wedding of the doctor?
Well, Chris, it wasn't. Unfortunately, well, okay, this is what's been going on. So I've been spending a lot of time watching Doctor Who. I've just started getting into the show. I'm at the end of season 4 now, making my way into season 5. I watched it probably 7 hours yesterday, which is kind of sad. And actually was almost late to a wedding today because I was trying to finish an episode and I finally just had to turn it off and get to the wedding. Luckily, I wasn't late. No, the doctor wasn't getting married, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, wearing my new Doctor Who t-shirt today. So it's been exciting. So that has been my weekend. Chris, I don't know, how's your weekend been?
My weekend's been pretty good. We pretty much punched LSU in the mouth yesterday, 38-17. So I'm very happy to have jumped that hurdle. And so a little sports ball talk for everyone there. But otherwise, you know, I've been busy with Star Trek stuff, of course, preparing for this show. And Saturday, I had a great chat with Armin Shimerman for MatterStream. And that's actually the first thing that I want to talk about today, which is just to plug the project that Armin is working on, because it's a really interesting thing. It's not a Star Trek project, but it is a very creative film project. It's a feature-length comedy that he's doing, and it's called Diani and Divine Meet the Apocalypse. And it's about the end of the world, but it's a comedy. But it has a good story behind it as well. And if you want to know all the details about it, go over and listen to the latest episode of my interview show, MatterStream. You'll find it, of course, iTunes and everywhere, but the show page is trek.fm/ms19. And, you know, Armin told me all about how he became involved in the project, what the premise is, who he's working with there. There's some familiar faces that everyone will know. And, of course, they have a Kickstarter campaign going on to help fund it. They're going to make this movie for $100,000, which is just, you know, bare bones when it comes to actually making any kind of film. And Diani and Divine, they've done other stuff in the past, great comedy, duo. And it's just, it's really, really interesting. And also during the discussion, besides talking about Meet the Apocalypse, we also touched a bit on a few things about Deep Space Nine. And we talked about sort of acting in general, creative, and of course, related to what we do at Trek FM as well, you know, how technology has opened the door for creatives and made it possible for us all, even actors like Armin, to do projects that would have been really difficult to do in the past.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, Chris. You know, you see this on Kickstarter, and a friend of mine actually made a film. He is a filmmaker in Little Rock, and I supported one of his films and helped him get it made, and it did really well. And so, you know, it's such a cool thing to be able to see people do things like this. And I love seeing that people inside the Hollywood establishment actually be able to use this to get smaller films made, and the kind of films that they really wanted to do for a long time and haven't gotten a chance to do. And this just gives them an opportunity to really stretch their creativity. And, you know, as George Lucas said about the original Star Wars, you know, having the limitations that they had put on them helped them be even more creative to get done what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you see those really low budget films, but the ones that have the dramatic punch or really funny or any of those kind of things, a lot of times it's because they've had to work within constraints of a very small budget.
Yeah.
And it helps make the film really good, because you're worried more about the acting, you're worried more about the storyline, the characters, and as we've talked about on The Orb a million times, you know, character is really what drives a good story anyway. So if you can start with that, you have that, you know, the film itself is going to be good, and people are going to like it as long as they watch it. And so you know, and with all the other types of media that we have out there with Netflix, Hulu, all that kind of stuff, you just get the ability to have people see things in a whole new way. So I'm really glad to see Armin getting into this. And I can't wait to actually listen to the episode myself. So,
yeah, it's really interesting. And he echoes some of what you just said, the fact that, you know, in the past you could make a small film, but how many people can watch it? And then now we have all these distribution channels, and it might seem odd, you know, for Hollywood people to be turning to things like Kickstarter and YouTube for distribution. But actually, all it is technology leveling the playing field for everyone. And he actually explains in there, this was interesting to me, one point why these types of small films were really, really difficult to make in the past. And it has to do with Hollywood and the union and how contracts were set up and everything. So anyway, go check it out. Really interesting discussion. Like I said, we've got a bit of Star Trek talk in there, a lot about Diani and Divine Meet the Apocalypse. And you can find out how you can support the project as well. So just if you're not already subscribed to MatterStream, I do have new shows coming out regularly now. You can go grab that in iTunes, get the enhanced version there. And again, go to the website trek.fm/ms19 for the show page for this episode. And check this out, and then, you know, all the back episodes of the show as well. Matthew, while we're talking about actors, another news story that we have this week is Kate Mulgrew, and she's going to be writing a memoir. Now, a lot of the actors from Star Trek have written fantastic memoirs, especially William Shatner has done some really great ones, and now Kate is preparing to tell everyone about her life as well.
Yeah, I thought this was really neat, Chris, and I really appreciate when an actor will sit down and do this and kind of give us a sneak peek into, or just a deep inside look into their life. You know, she's going to apparently get into a lot of things that, you know, you may have only heard peripherally about her, or, you know, she may have talked about a little bit somewhere, but, you know, she's had her time as an unwed mother, giving up her daughter for adoption when she just started out acting. And the fact that, you know, her and her daughter were actually reunited in 2001, you know, so things like that. This is really interesting. And Kate has lived, I think, a very full and meaningful life. And you can see, I think, even in just the way that she played Janeway, if you've seen her in any convention appearances, you know, she's so full of life. And I think she has so much to offer. So I'll be really interested, actually, to be able to read this and just get a deeper look into her. I think she's really interesting. You know, it's funny, I'm surprised, but I wish that they would cast her as a Katharine Hepburn in something, in like a you know, like a bio movie about her as she got older or something. Because to me, that's who she's always reminded me of, is a more modern day Katharine Hepburn.
Is it Katharine Hepburn who she does her own one person stage play about? Is that Katharine Hepburn?
You know, she might. So. And yeah, which would make sense because there's so much they have in common. Her voice is very similar as well. So yeah, this is going to be something I think is going to be really exciting. And I mean, of course, think about this too. This will come out in 2015. She'll be 60, and she has a hit show, you know, on Netflix, Orange is the New Black. And so kind of really pushing that envelope and breaking that ceiling for women over a certain age in Hollywood and still being very, very successful. So great to see Kate in this and going to share more of her life with us. And so, and I'm sure plenty of female Star Trek fans, male Star Trek fans will be very excited to be able to get to know her even better. And she's a great role model, I think, in a lot of ways for women everywhere, no matter what you've been through. So,
yeah, definitely so. Yeah, I was just confirming what I was thinking of. It is Tea at Five. That's her one-person show that she does about...
That's right. That's Catherine what I'm thinking of.
Hepburn. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're talking about someone casting her like in a film or something where she's cast.
Yeah, I'd
Hepburn.
Love to see her in a film playing, you know, maybe an older Katharine Hepburn and stories about her. She's perfect for that. And she's that, yeah. So that's something I would love to see her able to do.
Yeah. And, you know, we learned a lot about her background and the start of her acting career on The Captains that William Shatner did, where she talks about her father, you know, not being really keen on what she was doing and how she kind of deceived him and got to New York. And but the book will be interesting because she'll be able to delve so much more deeply into it. So I'm definitely looking forward to this, and I'm really hoping that there is an audio version of this with her reading it, because William Shatner has read all of his books and it's just so much better when you hear them telling the story themselves, because yeah, it's a book, but it's really them telling, it's like they're sitting down with you and telling the story. So I do hope she does that as well.
Yeah, I think that she definitely should. And mainly too, because just think about this. I mean, how many times do you get to hear somebody tell you their life story and it's actually them telling it. And I love that Shatner did that with his books. And there's nothing better than having, I think, somebody, if they can read their own autobiography, it does give you that personal touch. And, you know, a lot of times when you read a great autobiography, you can hear that person's voice if you're in your head, you know, kind of telling you the story. And what a great way to be able to experience somebody's life.
Most definitely. So we'll be watching for that. It's supposed to come out in May of 2015. So got a little ways to go right there. Who knows? Maybe by then Voyager will be starting out on Blu-ray to coincide. Who knows?
There you go.
Could be. All right. Well, we have one more story about an actor today in the news, and that's J.G. Hertzler, General Martok from Deep Space Nine. And he's taking a next step toward becoming chancellor, as he has been elected to the town board of the town of Ulysses, New York, which is near Ithaca.
Yeah, I mean, already starting here, I mean, this is what's going to happen. We're going to have the Klingon Chancellor be president one day. I think it's going to happen. They'll probably do the inauguration speech in Klingon. maybe he'll wear, you know, a really nice Klingon outfit like Worf did when he got married. I think it would be fantastic. But yeah, this is really cool. The fact that he's involved in politics and he feels like he has something to offer. That he really wants to do something that meaningful and impactful. And I guess we've seen this a lot, you know, in actors, you know, getting into politics. It's, you know, Reagan and
remember
Schwarzenegger. And,
you know, I would have voted for her somehow. I would have moved my voter registration, I think, last year when Ensign Leffler was planning to run for Senate from Kentucky. Of course, Ashley Judd.
Yes, yes. Which then, of course, she didn't. Yes, I felt bad for you. Yeah, you know, she only thought about it.
I think she will later on. I mean, you know, she's going to implement Leffler's laws.
Oh, well, I don't think I'd have any problem following my foolish laws, so.
But it's interesting here to see Hertzler getting elected, and like you say, maybe one day, who knows, maybe we will have President Martok, and that's when, of course, there will be a constitutional amendment to change the name of the office to Chancellor so that we can have Chancellor Martok.
It would be fantastic. But yeah, this is cool. I love seeing, you know, Star Trek people kind of move forward and really doing something with themselves. And I think this is one of those neat things is that Star Trek actors a lot of times tend to be involved in things that are more important than just acting
right
after they've been involved in Star Trek. And it's great to see them go on and do those things that are actually the best of what Star Trek has for us, and really giving of yourself. And to see him do this is inspirational. So
it really is. So this was an interesting story that was there. And so that wraps up our hat trick. Is that a hat trick, Matthew? We had three stories about actors to lead off news today.
I think so, Chris. I mean, I went to my first hockey game this weekend, but I don't really know all the rules. I'm not really a big, huge hockey fan, but awesome seats. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, I think
maybe who cares? We'll call it the Star Trek hat trick.
Oh, the Star Trek hat trick. Yeah. I saw your photos from going to the Dallas game there and
Stars game. Yeah.
But like you said, you don't know all the rules to the game. Based on your photos, I think that the star of the night was actually the beer that you were drinking.
Yeah, it was excellent. I had a quite expensive Heineken. But yeah, it was a good night. Fantastic seats. I can't. Yeah, a friend of mine called me up. He's like, "Hey, what are you doing on Saturday night?" I was like, "I'm not busy." He's like, "You want to go to a Stars game?" Yes. And then, of course, the seats were fantastic. Like 11 rows up. So it was amazing experience. So what can I say? I got the hookup.
Sounds like fun. I haven't been to a hockey game in years and years and years. But we used to go to the Birmingham Bulls hockey games, which was
nice.
Kind of minor league hockey back in the day. So, all right. Well, let's take a break from our news for a moment, Matthew, and remind everybody about our sponsor, Zoe. We've talked about Zoe the past few weeks here on the show. And Zoe is the world's first personal voice companion. And of course, we have things like Siri and we have Google as well. But Zoe is really interesting to Star Trek fans because it's not just a capability of your phone. It's actually a Star Trek type comm badge that you would wear. It's a device that you wear, a small badge that enables services with things that you use all the time, like Facebook or Twitter. It works with your phone, but it's platform independent. So it has a companion app that goes along with Android, with iOS, with BlackBerry, and with Windows Phone. And it enables you to do things, you know, give commands like turn off the air conditioner or give me traffic conditions. But it also can do things for you like read your Twitter messages or your Facebook posts. It can tie you into your music apps to play whatever music you'd like to hear, play your favorite podcasts like The Ready Room. And it also enables person-to-person communications without the need for phone calls. And Matthew, how could your weekend have been better if you had Zoe clipped to you as you went to the hockey game and the wedding and,
oh, gosh,
and such?
Ah, it would have been awesome, Chris. I wouldn't have had to look down at my phone, you know, and somebody tweeted me or messaged me. I would just have him read it to me, which that might be a little awkward, though. I mean, you're sitting in a big game or whatever, and somebody, like, messages you, and you have it read it out loud, and you're like, oh, son of a gun, I did not want that read out loud. you know, like, just somebody messaged you something, maybe you were having a private conversation about something going on in somebody's life, and or they said something to you that you wouldn't really share with everybody, and it's reading it to you out loud. So, but that part would have been really nice, because, you know, then you wouldn't miss any of the plays during a game or things like that. So yeah, that my life could have been made so much better if I'd had this.
Yeah, well, I think you should only ask Zoe to read your private messages out loud to you when you are alone, not when you're in the press box.
Well, exactly.
At a hockey game,
so. Yeah, not the place at the Platinum Club.
What if you're at the wedding And they say, if anyone out there knows any reason why this man and woman should not be married, what if Zoe piped in with her own opinion about this?
And she's like, nope, sorry. I've been watching this couple for the last 3 minutes. Don't think this is going to work.
It's going to work. That would be interesting. But no, seriously, Zoe, it's very small. And you just clip it on, and it really is like the genesis of the comm badge that you see in the Next Generation that you just wear there on your uniform. And it's another thing that's great about Zoe. One thing that I really love is that unlike some of the technologies that we currently have, like Siri, Zoe is very extensible. There is an API, there's a connection that they call voice modules, and that allows third-party developers to tie anything they want to into Zoe. So the capabilities of Zoe are really unlimited. It's really open. And I know that there are going to be amazing things done with it as time goes on, you know, even beyond the amazing capabilities that it has right out of the box. Now, Zoe is under development right now, and they have a Kickstarter campaign going on to help fund the project. Their goal is to raise $100,000 to further development. And as of right now, I checked, they've raised $34,122, which is almost three times where they were last week. So there's clearly a lot of interest out there amongst people who want to have this comm badge technology, but they also need a lot more support. So go contribute before the campaign ends. And there are seven different incentive levels, ranging from $5 to $10,000 that you can choose from. You can get anything from t-shirts to an actual seat on the advisory board of Zoe. And if you go for that, they'll even fly you out to Washington, all expenses paid, for the annual advisory board meeting. But whatever different levels you choose from, you have an opportunity to reserve a Zoe device for yourself for a special price of just $149. And I'm, as I said last week, Matthew, right now, I'm just trying to figure out which color I want. And I don't think I've made a decision yet. There are so many great colors there, but I'm definitely going to have to go in for this.
Yeah, Chris, this is really cool. I love that people are inspired still by Star Trek and trying to create technology that actually does make our lives different and better. You know, it's so much of my life has seen the coming to fruition of Star Trek technology, whether mm-hmm. it was, you know, the flip phone, or, you know, our iPhones are just as powerful in a lot of ways as a tricorder, you know, things like this. Pads, I mean, our pads are way beyond what you saw on, you know, like the Next Generation or Deep Space Nine. Yep. But as was funny, the episode we're going to talk about tonight, I was, you know, catwalk, Archer is watching the game, the
water polo
game, yeah. Yeah. On his pad.
Yeah.
When I was like, Captain Picard can't even do that, but right. Archer can do that.
That's right.
On his, it looks like a Nook or, you know, a Kindle Fire or something.
Maybe so. Picard can do it, but he's just not into sports ball. So
that's true. He really isn't. Yeah, he's way too into. In fact, I feel like Picard would just be watching productions of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah.
You know,
so.
That's
yeah.
what he gets
on Space Earth. Tube. Yeah.
EX Space 2.
You'd have to watch it in four or five parts because there's an upload limit.
Exactly. Well, you know, the bandwidth that far into space, it's a little low. So.
It is, yeah. Yeah. All right. So go check it out. Go to their Kickstarter page. They have a really great Kickstarter page that really outlines all the details of the device and shows you a lot of examples of the real-world benefits and how this device, beyond being a novelty, which, you know, it may sound like to some people, actually is very beneficial and helps people live a better life. So go check it out. Go to zoe.me/trekfm. That's zoe.me/trekfm. And be sure to include the Trek FM portion of the URL when you visit so Zoe knows you heard about it here on the Ready Room. All right, Matthew, let's move on to our next news story. This one I'm really excited about. Now, we did this a couple of weeks ago. We previewed two tracks from 5-Year Mission's album Year 3 that's going to be coming out soon. We also talked about the Kickstarter campaign that they had going on to help fund the mastering and the pressing of the album. And that campaign was a huge success. They were looking for $1,500 just to press Year 3. They actually got $4,860 in that campaign.
Yeah, Chris, I thought this was great, the fact that so many people went in and supported them. Hopefully they had heard it, you know, with us talking about it and had gone in. And, you know, I thought it was great, too, is the fact that listening to these tracks, they sound fantastic. I really think that they sound good. It sounds like as good as anything you'd get and download off of iTunes in the first place, from any studio. Yeah. So really well done. And the fact that they're going to have the money to get this mastered professionally and to get this put out there is great. And they're great songs.
They really are. And we have the unmastered copies. Right now, we don't have the mastered
ones. Which is crazy to think that these are the unmastered copies. I can't imagine what these are going to sound like, because these already sound just as good as anything, again, that I would have downloaded off of iTunes anywhere from any artist out there.
They really do. And of course, 5-Year Mission has been a great friend of the show and the network for quite a few years now. And when Year 2 came out, we previewed all the tracks over the course of... I guess maybe 2 months. We did like 2 tracks a week. There are 16 tracks on each album. So we're going to do that again right now with Year 3. Mike has been very generous to let us have advanced copies of the tracks so that we can listen and share them with you. And today we're going to preview the first 2 tracks off the album. And the first one is The Changeling. So let's play a clip of that. All right, Matthew, I love the style of the Changeling here, and tell me if you got this visual. I know Nomad is just one probe, but he refers to himself as We Are Nomad, and I just picture him like going through the ship, la, 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 high-fiving himself as he, you know, gets rid of all the impurities of those, you know, those pesky carbon-based life forms.
Yeah, that would be. I was picturing that myself, and that's really funny. Nomad doesn't have any hands, so I mean, I'm not really sure what he'd high-five.
Well, it's like
with.
Inside him, you know. Like I said, he's
high-fiving
himself.
Oh yeah, maybe
himself.
He has like little arms that come up, you know, like.
Oh, maybe we didn't high-five. See that, did we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you know how like R2-D2 has all those little, you know, things that can come out of his chest there and do things. That's what Nomad has. We didn't see the super upgraded version of the episode where, you know, Nomad's walking down or flying down the halls and he's like high-fiving people. That's that's what we need, the super edited, re-edited version of that episode.
Maybe so, maybe so. So that's what I was picturing as I'm listening to The Changeling. Let's go on to the next track, which is Mirror, Mirror, and play a clip of that. So, Matthew, what did you think about Mirror, Mirror?
I like the sound of this one. It kind of has that indie rock kind of sound to it. And I was just picturing, you know, bad Spock walking down the corridors, you know, and he's all conflicted and confused, and he's got his iPod on, and he's listening to his indie rock music, trying to sort things out, and stroking his goatee as he does, because he's definitely looking hipster with that goatee. So.
I was going to say, did you feel like this track has a little goatee to it?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's like hipster Spock.
So these are the first two tracks off the album, The Changeling and Mirror Mirror. The rest of the tracks on Year 3 are The Apple, The Doomsday Machine, Cat's Paw, I Mud, Metamorphosis, Journey to Babel, Friday's Child, The Deadly Years, Obsession, Wolf in the Fold, The Trouble with Tribbles, The Gamesters of Triskelion, A Piece of the Action, and The Immunity Syndrome. And we will be previewing these tracks each week on the show over the next few weeks to help lead into the launch of Year 5. And we really do encourage you guys to go and support the band, because I have Year 1 and Year 2. I listen to them all the time still. I love the tracks. The guys are all great. Noah, Andy, Patrick, Mike, and Chris. And again, these guys do, they've all been musicians and members of bands in the Indianapolis area for years and years. But of course, they have their own jobs, and this is something they do because they love music and they love Star Trek. And go support what they're doing and grab the album, because they're really creative guys, very, very talented. And I hope that they do well with Year 3, and so we'll get Year 4. They're going to do 5 altogether. It's the 5-year mission, obviously. And we'll fit them all in there. And who knows, maybe they'll go beyond TOS and move into TNG after this. I'm not sure, but we'll ask them when we have them on the show coming up soon.
Ooh, or they could do the TOS movies. And so you could do, you know, a special EP with all 6 original movies, you
That's
know,
a good
that
idea.
Would be pretty cool.
That's a good idea. And they do EPs. They did a Trouble with Tribbles EP. So,
and then you could, instead of doing all of The Next Generation, you could just do a small EP with all 4 Next Generation films as well.
And then they can do Nemesis, and they can remove all of the Star Trek elements from the song. Is that what you want them to do?
Exactly. So there wouldn't be anything remotely sounding of Star. In fact, it would just be a song that they wrote about how they wished they were going to a Star Trek movie, and instead they saw this movie called Nemesis. And then, of course, we're just planning out their future, Chris. And then you do the special EP JJ-verse version with the 3 different films that we'll get in that trilogy. So, man, they've got plenty of material left.
With an introductory track by Joe Cornish?
Maybe. I don't know how you do lens flare audially. That's going to be tough.
Well, you know, JJ says he feels bad about the lens flares now, so maybe you don't want to do that. He finally admitted he went overboard.
I mean, but I'm just saying that first movie is full of them, so... You know, I don't know how you couldn't have that involved somehow in the song. Maybe the song could be called Lens Flare of My Heart or something.
I've got it. It's like a electric guitar screech. The screeches the audio equivalent of lens flares.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, or you know how you have the blues guitar and you have the slide sound, you know, with the steel slide. Mm-hmm. That could be the lens flare, you know, so it could be very bluesy. So something like that.
That's like just randomly mixed into every track on the album.
Right. Yeah. It just comes and goes. You never know what's going to be there. But when they mix it in, it fits well enough. So it's not so, you know, obnoxious that you're like, oh gosh, I want this album to end.
It's an interesting idea. All right. Well, you can find 5-Year Mission over on their website at 5yearmission.net. That's the word 5, 5yearmission.net. And we're looking forward to Year 3. Okay, Matthew, let's go on. We have one more thing in news today. These are questions from the fleet, and we have 2 questions from Gene Russell. And we were going to do one of them on last week's show, and we didn't have a chance to get to it. So we're going to do both of them today. And again, this is our listener, Gene Russell, in Salt Lake City. And the first question that Gene asks is, if you could have any Star Trek decor in your home, what would it be? And he said in his message to us, For example, Worf's weird statue of two naked Klingons wrestling, or the painting of the Enterprise-D in Picard's ready room. Gene says he's always wanted the big Delta shield behind the podium in Star Trek VI when Spock explains that the Klingon Empire is dying, and Scotty explains that he just bought a boat. So what would you do in your room there?
Oh, Chris, the idea of Star Trek decor, you know, I had to go with this because I've just been drooling over it ever since it came out. The Enterprise refit model from QMX, it's $7,000. But I've never seen a better model, I think, of this ship, except maybe the one that they sold at the big auction they had. And I don't really know where I'd put a 6-foot model. So this one's a little bit more reasonable for, you know, having in the house. But I mean, this thing is just exquisite. The paint job on it is fantastic. If you know anything about the model, you know they had that kind of iridescent, pearly paint job that was so hard to recreate. And, you know, any model maker has a really hard time doing it as well. So these guys, the work here, the ship literally looks like it flew out of, you know, one of the scenes. So that would be for me. There's just no way, and I think that I'll ever have, you know, a $7,000
little pricey
prop model. Yeah, for me. So that's the thing that I would love to have.
As far as where you would put it, now I know it gets a little toasty there in Texas in the summer, Matthew, but as I'm looking at your room right now, I think you could just take that ceiling fan out of the room and just hang the ship from the ceiling. I think it would look perfect. Then you'd have space.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I'd love it. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful model. Goodness. It would be the prize collection for me, you know, prize of my collection, obviously. So, yeah, it would be great to have. That's definitely a dream. A very, very pricey dream. You can buy a car almost, you know, used car for that amount of money. So,
well, I think for me, now here in the studio, I have very nice dark hardwood floors, but I wouldn't mind replacing those floors. Now, this might be a little bit extreme, but I'd like to replace the floors in the studio with the floor from the Romulan Senate, where you've got the map of the galaxy and you've got the border Romulan Empire and the Federation on the other side. I think that would be really sharp. And then I would feel, you know, when I come in to edit shows, I would feel like I'm really in a command center from the world of Star Trek.
Man, that would be fantastic, Chris. I think, oh gosh, that would just be beautiful. That flooring was really well done. That whole set was beautiful too. I thought that was one of the, I mean, if we've been knocking Nemesis this whole time, but that was one of the things I feel like they did really well, was the set decoration there. And in fact, just the look of Romulus itself, you know, they had that big sweeping shot where you come in into the Senate and everything. That was all well done. So, bravo. Good choice.
But, you know, it might be kind of expensive to do that. So if I can't pull that off, the next thing I was thinking about was, you know, off to the side of me here, I have the big glass door that goes out onto the patio. I could replace my blinds with the Enterprise transporter room shower curtain.
Oh, there you go. That would be great. Now, Chris,
a little cheaper.
I thought about it. For what I would love an entire set of mugs from Deep Space Nine. You know how they all the different style mugs, yeah. You know, from so I'd love the ones you'd see at Quark's or the Replimat or of course the ones on the Defiant. All of those were I really enjoy Star Trek drinkware. So just Star Trek drinkware all across the board. If I could have some props from the shows, I'd love to have it. I have one of the mugs that's just like Janeway's mug from Thermos. Mm-hmm. Her coffee mug that she loves so much. I have one of those. And I was lucky. I spent 4 years, 4 years looking for one on eBay, finally found somebody selling one for about $30, which was a steal, because anybody who's worth their salt realizes that you sell that on eBay and you say Janeway's coffee mug and you put it at about $250 because they're so hard to find. Mm-hmm. So I take that thing camping with me. That would be great. Star Trek drinkware from all of the shows would be fantastic.
That would be cool as well. Well, let's go to the next question from the fleet. And this, again, is from Gene. And he asks, if you could see... This actually stemmed from our discussion about Joe Cornish possibly directing Star Trek III and whether we thought it would be a good move or a bad move for the franchise, because the general public maybe doesn't know who he is that well. And, you know, do you go for a bigger name or do you go for someone who comes from outside of Star Trek? And Gene asks, if you could see any wrong for Trek, in quotation marks, director's interpretation of Star Trek, which would it be? He says, there are many directors who will probably never direct Star Trek because of their distinct style. I don't ever see guys like Wes Anderson, Tim Burton, Quentin Tarantino, or Clint Eastwood directing a Star Trek movie. And then he asks, you know, who would we see there? Now, through the show today, just by accident, we've been talking a lot about Nemesis, and I think that Stuart Baird is a wrong for Trek director who directed a Star Trek movie, and most fans will agree that the results weren't very good. But how would you answer Gene's question here?
You know, I was thinking about this guy. You might have heard of him. I don't know. He's a smaller TV guy. J.J. Abrams.
So he's your wrong for Trek director.
Yeah, or maybe Robert Wise. I don't know. Those are the two. I'm just kidding. Just thinking of two people that, especially Robert Wise, like who would have ever thought he would have directed a Star Trek movie? Well, I mean, the guy who did, you know, Sound of Music. Right. You don't really picture being a Star Trek director. So,
well, even Nick Meyer coming in, I mean, he was not from Star Trek.
Exactly.
And, you know, he made the best Star Trek films that we have around. So,
right. So, you know, I think it's really hard to say what somebody would do with Star Trek if they, you know, they had it in their hands. You know, the guy on this list, even as he's just mentioned, the guy I couldn't ever see doing Star Trek whatsoever is Wes Anderson. I think I would love to see Star Trek because I really enjoy his films, most of them. And so if I was going to pick a wrong for Star Trek director, I think it might be Wes Anderson.
Yeah. I think this is an interesting question because, like, I can't see any of these people actually directing a Star Trek movie that's going to be put out there as this is the next Star Trek movie and all the fans are going to come see it. But I think seeing the interpretation of Star Trek that each of these directors would have would be really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine a Tim Burton Star Trek film?
Oh, gosh.
And what that would look
yeah,
like?
Yeah, or a Quentin Tarantino Star Trek. I mean,
right.
Talk about a bloodbath.
And now Clint Eastwood could be great if it were a Worf film, because Worf likes to shoot at everything and, you know, could have like a Western-style movie. The person who Gene didn't mention that came to mind for me would be an M. Night Shyamalan Star Trek film.
God. Oh, that, please, let's not talk about him at all. He hasn't done a good movie since The Sixth Sense. I can't stand him.
But can't you imagine
anymore?
A movie where at the end of the movie Kirk thinks that he's seeing dead crew members and it turns out that he's dead?
I could imagine it sucking. I mean,
or imagine the opening
that he's a superhero and he doesn't know it, or that if you just dump water on the aliens they die, or
what if you take the, like my wife said after seeing Into Darkness, she wanted to know more about what happened to the civilization on Nibiru after the Enterprise was revealed to this primitive civilization and Kirk and Bones are running through the red cornfields. Imagine that combined with Signs. So you've got the cornfields, but they're red in this case. There are aliens coming, but it's the Enterprise. I think, you know, Shyamalan could do something with that.
Sure. I just can't imagine him as a, when you, he, in my mind, is such a horrible director anymore that I don't want to see him do anything else. But that's just me.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, of course, we're not suggesting that any of these people would be good for actually doing a Star Trek film. But it would be really interesting to see their interpretation of Star Trek.
It would. It would be very interesting. And, you know, I think watching, and you know, it'd be kind of cool just to have them do, like, you know, short, like, 10-minute films, and each person get 10 minutes to tell a story. And, you know, even if you just did it in, like, animation or something. Uh-huh. So each person, and so, like, you know, Wes Anderson would do kind of those stop motion. You know, Tim Burton would give us a claymation, like Nightmare Before Christmas or something. Quentin Tarantino would just have tons of blood. Clint Eastwood, Kirk would just be telling people, do you feel lucky? Do you, punk? Ooh. Or it could be Worf doing that, you know. Assimilate this.
Worf could pull it off.
So, I mean, yeah. Yeah, we could do this. I could see this happening.
All right. Well, thanks, Gene, for the questions. And for everyone else, if you have questions about Star Trek, anything about Star Trek that you would like us to answer here on The Ready Room, just send us your questions. Questions from the fleet. Go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. There's an option on the pull-down for questions from the fleet. So just choose that, and then that'll come to us, and we will answer your questions here on the show. Okay, Matthew, that's all we have in news today. Now we're going to jump into the feature. We're going to be joined by Larry to talk about Enterprise, the catwalk. Before we do that, we'd like to tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create your own blog, website, or portfolio, and of course, your own online store with the fantastic Squarespace Commerce feature that is now available in the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Spain. And as you and I discussed recently, Matthew, not on Bajor, but that might be coming soon.
Yes. I might be working on a special project we've talked a little bit about. And I guess, you know, if you've been listening to our shows, you're kind of aware of this. But me importing spring wine from Bajor, the Emissary Special Reserve is available. Just trying to get the import licenses worked out, which is tough because, as we've talked about, subspace can be a little spotty that far away. So,
right.
But look for it. It's coming on my new Squarespace website, springwine.com.
And it's very easy for you to set up a course because you've got the 30-second merchant sign-up that you use with Stripe. So, Matthew, you get instant approval for your spring wine business. It doesn't require any Excellent. Paperwork. You can begin receiving money via direct deposit in moments. Full tax and shipping is handled with rules by region, which is really important because especially in the US where, you know, each state has its own different tax rates and such, all that is handled by the system for you. So that's a huge time saver, and you don't need any additional software or tools to do that like you might on other platforms. And if you have existing inventory in Shopify or Big Cartel, you can move that over to Squarespace with just a few clicks. And you don't pay anything extra to Squarespace for commerce beyond just the normal package rate of $24 per month. You do pay a small processing fee to Stripe for your credit card processing, which you do with any kind of commerce system. Even, you know, any retail store has to pay that fee as well. So that's very standard. The other thing you can do with Squarespace is, as I mentioned, create your own blog or website or portfolio. Something we talked about earlier today, Matthew, gave me a great idea for a website I'd like to do, which is Leffler's Laws, which, again,
yes.
I don't need the commerce feature for that, but I can use all the fantastic blog tools, just like we use for Trek FM, because Trek FM is built on Squarespace as well. I can easily build that site, and I want to really delve deeply into Leffler's Laws. I want to create the most informative place on the web for you to find out just how Leffler would run your life. Because, you know, I mean, everyone who follows me on Twitter knows how much I love Loeffler. So that's what I'm going to do with it. But, you know, anything you want to create, you can do it so easily with Squarespace. And the best way to find out how is just to try it free for yourself. You can do that for 14 days and there's no credit card required. You have access to all the tools on Squarespace during that 14-day period. All you do is you just go to squarespace.com, enter your name and an email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be creating your own website, blog, or portfolio, or online store. And plans start at $8 per month. That's $16 for unlimited everything. And if you want to use the commerce feature that we talked about, that's just $24 per month. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using offer code TREK11. And if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. So please, no one run out and register loefflerslaws.com. I'm going to do that right after the show so I can get to work on that blog. Just go to squarespace.com, try it for free. That helps us bring the Ready Room to you every week. And don't forget to use offer code TREK11. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of the Ready Room and Trek FM.
For your party, the way I'm disco dancing, I'm a model, you know what I mean, and I do my little turn on the catwalk, yeah, on the catwalk, on the catwalk, yeah, I do my little turn on the catwalk.
One of the goals in writing for any series is to tell stories that can't be told anywhere else. With its early technology and proximity to our own time, Enterprise had an opportunity to put characters into situations that the other series couldn't. One great example is the idea of a ship lost at sea facing a terrible storm, and that's what we got in the second season episode, The Catwalk. And today we're going to talk about this episode, and to help us do that, we have back with us, friend of the show, and Dr. McCoy himself. It's Larry Nemechek. Hey, Larry, how's it going?
Hi. I feel very uncomfortable being called with D and Kurt out there.
You have to get comfortable with it, Larry, because as Wikipedia says, you are best known for playing Dr. McCoy in Star Trek Continues.
Oh, there you go reading Wikipedia again. Now, what have I told you about that, Chris? You can't. That'll get you in trouble every time. Yeah, that was very strange. I didn't have a Wikipedia. In fact, I even tweeted one day. I went, oh, so I have a Wikipedia page. I mean, I'd been wanting to have someone write one or do it. And anyway, it popped up. I guess it's because of Continues, which apparently someone has tunnel vision on. And if only I could do something with the rest of my life and my time on this earth.
It's just funny. So Matthew, Larry and I were talking. Larry told me that he has a Wikipedia page now, and it says, so despite the fact that Larry, you know, has written so much about Star Trek, been on the DVDs, all this stuff for the past couple of decades, according to Wikipedia, Larry is best known for playing the role of Dr. McCoy.
Wait, Larry's done other things? I mean, it's on the internet. It has
there
to be
go.
True.
There you go. See, I guess so. Silly me for questioning the internet. I know.
It's on Wikipedia. It's got to be true.
Wikipedia never lies.
Well, Larry, speaking of Trek Continues, your Kickstarter wrapped up, and I know you guys passed your goal, and I think you're able to reach some of your stretch goals, aren't you?
Yes. They were looking for a really big stretch goal, but no, the goal was 100,000, and it got 126,000, and we still had people popping in and going, I didn't know you were doing this. And so the 100,000 was for three episodes, and mainly for expenses and post and for new sets. And the stretch goals were for adding a fourth and fifth episode in the mix. So 126 was great. They did something that I don't know if other people have done, but they went ahead and put a PayPal donation page on and said, okay, if you feel left out, go ahead and do so, you know, put in some money. When we do another Kickstarter down the road, we'll count all this toward the next Kickstarter for the levels and things. So that was interesting.
Okay. So they'll credit you for incentives in the next campaign.
Your free toaster, you know, whatever.
Well, I was under the impression that the primary stretch goal for this campaign was to get you a mint julep.
A very big mint julep, Chris. But yeah. Speaking of stretch, yeah. No, we're having a war between Chris and an engineering set and me in a sick bay. And of course, he says, I don't have an engineering room at all. You at least have the ward room and all that. But no, it's really kind of amazing. It's really gratifying to read the comments from the fans, because forget that I'm involved with this, and forget that the sad thing about this was there's about four or five different projects also that I know of that I would like to see help. I would like to help. I would like to see them do well, and they've all come out at the same time. And I kind of was my loyalty was to continues. I mean, even the Farragut people had an Indiegogo campaign. That's our sister people. We share. It's their studio, and we. And there was just a lot of people doing that, and now I'm trying to rush around. And you talked to Armin with their project, and there's a lot of those going on. But I still come at it like the used car salesman thing. I mean, I'm still getting into my forget the acting and some of these other things. I'm still getting into my salesman and producer roles and wearing that skin. Because I don't like to be, you know, force-fed into used car salesman mode and being told to buy stuff. So, it's amazing to see how fans have reacted, and they embrace it so much. And reading some of the comments on the things, and how they're almost like, "This is so great! Here, you know, our kid phrase about, you know, here, take my money already. Shut up and take my money." Mm-hmm. it's amazing to read. It's kind of corny and hokey, and after all the years that I've just tried to like get the behind the scenes stories out of generations of Trek people, and that's kind of my niche or my original niche. To read how people are reacting to this, and you know, not just me, but all the people, all our camera people, and I mean behind the scenes and on camera people both, and the cast and crew, and it's really amazing. And there's great lines in there, and I'll just throw one out. There's one, and I had to retweet it. Somebody said, "Hey, I've got an idea for your next episode. Why don't you? Oh, now I'm going to mess this up. Why don't you find Ricardo Montalban and have him play Sherlock Holmes?" That's what it was.
Sounds like a good idea.
But anyway.
All right. Well, it's great that the campaign did so well and everyone's behind Trek Continues.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into Enterprise today.
Oh, that.
And Larry, this is the first time we've had you on for Enterprise, I believe. So we'll see what kind of information you have about the episode. But Matthew, why don't you kick us off, because you picked the episode today. And as I mentioned in the introduction, there's this idea. Of course,
now, Chris, since it's Enterprise, aren't we supposed to like sing the theme song since it's different from all the other when you do an Enterprise?
That's right. Okay, Matthew, I'm going to let you start with that because you're the best singer out of the group, I think. Could you do like a Vic Fontaine version of it?
Did you see Patch Adams, Matthew?
Let's see. I have. It's been a long time since I've seen that. Let's see. Cause I got faith. Oh, of the heart. I'm going where my heart will take me. Okay, that's enough of that.
I'm doing the back and forth.
That's my best Vic Fontaine style. you really need the drums in the background, you know, and the bass and the piano kind of.
You need Odo on
keys. Yeah, I need Odo.
You need the echo.
Oh, man. We got some good stuff
That'd
here.
That'd be great. All right. Well, okay. So, Matthew, it's like I said, you picked the episode. And
oh, you did? Okay.
As I mentioned in the intro, there's this idea of they put it in sci-fi wrappings. And, of course, part of the inspiration for the episode was Mike Sussman reading this article about the threat of radiation to astronauts who go to Mars in the future. But even more earthly to us here, this is the idea of a ship lost at sea with a terrible storm and the crew has to take refuge in the ship.
Yeah, I think that's something we've seen a lot of in movies. And you just, if you watch any movie that takes place on a sailing ship, you get this. I mean, Master and Commander is a great reference there in that film. You see the ship tossed about. They're doing everything they can to keep it together. You know, you don't know if you're going to make it or not. So taking that idea and putting it on Enterprise, I thought was really smart because this is a show and Brandon has talked about this, in interviews and with Enterprise, you wanted to see shows that couldn't happen on the other shows. You know, you wanted to see an episode that you couldn't see on The Next Generation, Voyager, TOS, any of those shows. And with this idea, with the technology you have being on Enterprise, kind of limited, they don't have shields yet, those kind of things, you would run into this problem, and you can't outrun this storm. And so trying to find a way to do a great character episode, which I think they do. This isn't honestly really a bottle show, because this probably cost a fortune to do. The special effects in here are quite extensive when they show the outside, the ship, the storm, and everything.
Mm-hmm. We have about five guest stars, so, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You've got tons of guest stars.
And a ton of uncredited
extras. Yeah, yeah. Yes, oh. Exactly. You know, so
this was the March of the Extras Parade show, actually.
So. Exactly. They really put a lot into this show, and I think it really. When I think of this episode, I think about all the great character moments you get and everything like that. But I just think this is an episode that you couldn't get with any of the other series, and I'm always drawn to it when I'm watching, just picking out an episode to watch just kind of randomly because of that. Not only that, you get a show that really utilizes, I think, the characters of Enterprise really, really well. So I really like this episode, and that's why, you know, I just chose it, because I think it's great. And two, Chris, I mean, I got to watch one of the episodes on the new Blu-ray, so that was the other impetus for choosing this episode.
That's part of our excuse, right?
Exactly.
We all have the season 2 Blu-ray sets, but we haven't had a chance to actually watch through them yet. So,
and you have to hold a phase pistol to your own head to watch the Blu-rays.
Oh yes,
scheduling.
Yes.
I know what you mean. I'll force.
Yeah.
You don't mean to, but
it winds
up.
Forced to watch the new Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But the thing for me is, like, I can throw them on, I can watch them while I'm working here in the studio, but I really want to watch them on the big television in the living room. And to do that requires a feat of scheduling.
Well, I was going to throw it in here and watch it on my iMac today. And I was like, no, Blu-ray won't play on your iMac, silly boy. Yeah.
So, Larry, I mentioned at the beginning the fact that, you know, I know that Mike Sussman had the idea for this episode after reading an article about the radiation and all. But, you know, Enterprise is one of those series where if you go to Memory Alpha and you want to find out the backgrounds behind the episodes, there's not very much.
Mm-hmm. It's because I haven't talked publicly about it yet.
That's right. It hasn't been transcribed yet, right? What kind of background do you have about this episode?
Well, I was just I have a lot of stuff with Mike and even some notes about Porthos, because even, you know, it was cool that they not only had Porthos in this, but all of Phlox's critters, which was kind of cool. And you know, suddenly now that he needs 20 cubic, you know, meters or whatever of storage space. You were mentioning the Mars version. Mike had told me, I was looking back through some notes here, that he had said that he'd read an article about this, just the space station. For solar flares and radiation and getting to the middle of the station and doing that. And the name of this was originally called the Core, and they were going to get it like in a computer core like the Enterprises have, the Kirks and Picards both. And they couldn't figure out how to have the boarding aliens not find them. He said, what? There's like, they forget to knock on this one door that they're all hiding behind. And that's how, you know, and that it was actually Rick that said, well, let's stick them up in the cell. Cause who's going to go look for people up along, you know, something that's kind of half radiated to begin with. So, and he compared it to kind of a Key Largo, you know, we're a ship in a storm. We've got people trapped, in a hotel, uninvited guests. And that's all the tension that creates. And that the three guys that come aboard in the beginning from this race, you know, they debated on whether to have them be really bad guys or be, you know, sympathetic or whatever. And it wound up they were kind of stupid but sympathetic. So, you know, it's a good lesson in just kind of how they evolved along. But that was everybody gave Rick credit for saying, let's put them in the cell. And then I started thinking, compared to all the series, it's like, you almost forget this, and you always think of the third season of the original series as like the cheapo year when they were cutting the sets and cutting the budgets and everything. But the one time that we actually got hands-on with the warp engines was in That Which Survives, and Scotty's in the crawlway, and he's actually accessing the antimatter flow, you know, that's protecting the antimatter. And they actually, for a cheap little effect, they actually did a good job with that. And but it was very simple, like just a little. It was almost like they had I think they took the Jeffries tube, cut it down the middle, and pulled it apart, and had flat, you know, 4x8 plywood down the middle and made it wider. But it's like that was third season, and Next Generation, a cool thing that I know they built into, that Mike and Rick built into the ship that they could get to, and finally did a story with it, was Eye of the Beholder, when we actually go up in the nacelles of the D, you know, in the Galaxy class. Mm-hmm. And right. It's like, okay, well, let's see. Original series was third season. Next Generation was the sixth season. It was kind of a moot point on DS9 because they were either too busy running around somewhere or fighting a war. They never got to, you know, the ships weren't the main thing of that show. And Voyager, they didn't go up in the nacelles so much, but there was a late season show, sixth or seventh, where they went down to the bottom deck. And Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine is on duty down there or something, and she finds him. I think it's Good Shepherd. But it's kind of interesting that we talk about Enterprise and how they were faring on their stories, and how maybe they ran through their pile of stuff to get to. You know, like, let's invent the photon torpedo. Let's invent the holodeck. And they ran through all that in a year, and it's like, this is the second season. And it's a cool idea to look at it from that perspective, but if you're going to find the nooks and crannies of the ship, it's like it's the second season and they're already there. So if you want to say they've jumped the catwalk and they've already, you know, I mean, it's a cool idea, but it just struck me how that's the kind of thing that the other series would get into late, and how, once again, here's poor Enterprise mm-hmm. jumping into a thing like that. But it's still a cool story, and I thought they handled it well as far as actually realizing what it would be like to do that. And
well, I think the other thing that it did, besides showing the nooks and cranny of the ship like that, which again was great because it feels real, even when Archer's in his quarters and he's looking out the window at the storm coming towards them, the neutronic wave front, as I remembered as we were talking in the other side of the room about what it was called. Like, how can I not remember that? But he sees the storm coming, and even there you get that feeling of like being on a small ship. Mm-hmm. On the ocean with this massive wave coming towards you. And so the ship really does feel small, but even though the ship is small, the crew don't normally have to spend so much time together in quarters as close as they do in this episode. And here everyone's forced together. They're forced to be in confinement with each other. And it really works well for the character element of the story. And of course we see kind of, you know, tempers flare a little bit, especially with Reed. But another thing that I really liked about it was the fact that you have crew members who never really get to see the captain very much, even though it's a small crew, you know, they don't interact with the captain all that much. And you have that one crew member, that girl who comes up to Archer and just asks him, do you know the name of the first Vulcan ambassador to Earth? And Archer says, I think...
It's Sokar.
Sokar. Six-letter word.
And she says, thanks, Captain. And I thought that was just a nice moment because it's someone who doesn't get to see the captain very much, but you can see how Archer, as the captain, cares about his crew. I felt there was a great moment there, especially just the way Scott Bakula said that, and of course her reaction as well. And bringing the crew together like that, the camaraderie, is a great part of the story.
I think it's one of those things that I really liked about this episode. Again, in referencing Master and Commander, there's a great scene where they have they're chasing the ship, and it's late at night, and he's invited all of the senior staff to his quarters to have a dinner, and they just kind of... rank is still there, but it's stripped down, so everybody's kind of more on an equal playing field, and this episode really does that. You know, everybody is just kind of more on a level playing field, and the crew is learning what it's like to live in a much smaller confined area and learning about each other much quicker. And, you know, I think what's really great about this episode is everybody has something to do. There's nobody who's misused in this episode. Like, When Mayweather talks about space, that, you know, mm-hmm. what his experience was like, it actually has something to do with the episode, and it adds more to the episode. You know, when we watch Trip kind of deal with this idea of he's trying to be a good host to these aliens and he's really frustrated. And he doesn't bring it out on those aliens. He brings it out on the captain. He just goes and he can vent to Archer, you know. Great banter between Archer and T'Pol in this episode. And so I feel like everybody's utilized really, really well. And that, you know, Enterprise, if it has a failing, it is not really to bring the main cast together enough. And this episode just takes each one of those characters, utilizes them well. And I wish we had just seen kind of more of this stuff on Enterprise with this idea of we have a really tiny ship. I mean, it only has 5 decks. It's not a massive ship. It feels more like a submarine anyway. I would have loved to have seen kind of more of that closeness throughout the crew and the main 5 cast members more often. And so more of this kind of stuff, I think, would have been fantastic.
No, that's true, yeah. The basic premise of cramming them all in there. And then, of course, then it's like then the other, they use the catwalk again. It got me that for all the time and energy and cost of building this set, they really only used the catwalk one other time. And the episode escapes me what they called it, the handkerchief aliens, or the Kleenex aliens. And you would have thought that they would have gone back to this more than once, unless, I mean, I would hope that they weren't just a one joke set, you know, like, well, if we go to the catwalk, then that means we're in some catastrophe. And how many times can we do a catastrophe show where we're all stuck in the, you know, but it really worked well here. And like you said, mixing the crew in.
I think the catwalk on Enterprise would have been the perfect place for Argyle's great-great-grandfather to make his gin. You know, in the Enterprise D, he does it in the Jeffries tubes.
I must have missed that, but you know, this is the show. Speaking of using all the, this is the one time, aside from Riker playing him in the holodeck in that horrendous finale, this is the one time we actually physically see Chef.
That's right. You see his arm and his legs. So
you see his legs. Yeah,
you see him like from the and so for the trivia question of who played Chef, there actually is somebody in that outfit. Do you know who it is?
Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Damn it. How did you get into my...
Because he's everywhere.
It's playing Chef that inspired him to go off and do his one-man show of Edgar Allan Poe. You don't see the link there? Because Chef was from Baltimore, and... Okay, no, I'm totally...
Well, that explains the Raven stew that he was always making for the crew that most people didn't like, but for some reason...
It's a little gamey.
T'Pol, even though she's a vegetarian, she...
And of course, being Enterprise, when they talk about what it was made of, he had to say, oh, it's an Earth Raven stew, because you always have to put the planet in front of the...
Right.
You know, yeah. It sounds a little redundant when they're all from Earth, but... No, that was... the guy in the chef outfit was Richard Starset, who had been a stand-in, who had been... he was on all the modern shows. From he was on Next Gen and Voyager and Enterprise.
Oh wow!
He was Frakes' stand-in for Riker on Voyager. He was Chakotay's stand-in, even though he didn't have a dark complexion. And he wasn't a stand-in, but he was just around as an extra a lot on Next Generation. And if you look at like the finale, like the end of the runs, they would throw him on as an admiral and give him a line or two at the end of Next Generation and the end of he's one of the admirals standing with Paris in the last scene of Voyager, and I think he has a line.
Oh yeah.
But he was an 18-year-er or almost 18 years. So it was really funny that he was the guy in the pants. So there's your ultimate trivia question. Who played Chef? And besides Jonathan Frakes, it was Richard Starset.
Ta-da. The guy in the pants.
The guy in
the guy
pants.
In the pants.
What
I wonder
is the
how
bigger
his waveform
mystery?
Is.
What is the bigger mystery identity on Enterprise, Chef or Future Guy?
I'm sorry, is there a Future Guy on Enterprise? That's
Yeah, in the Temporal Cold War. Future Guy, the humanoid figure.
That's how much of a mystery it is. It escapes your memory when you're, what exactly was that? I mean, it's like been 10 years and Brandon still can't figure out what he was supposed to be. So anyway, but I just thought that was cool. But again, here's my weird thing on this. It's like, oh, you want to talk about the story of this show? It's like all the weird little things about this episode, like the chef. Like, yes, it was cool that female, I wish they would give them names, but the female crew member who was doing the crossword puzzle. and ask him what the six-letter word ending in R for the, and he says mm-hmm. Soul Car, which of course is a tie back to that's supposed to be Spock's great grandfather. It was Sarek's mm-hmm. grandfather that we get out of the line from Search for Spock. And then they've retconned it into being by this line here. And look, and again, look who's wrote this episode: Mike Sussman, one of the leading fanboys in the team. So he's always looking to cram little bits of trivia and tie downs into things. And he was very thrilled to, although it doesn't come out and just knock it in the head, he told me, and I have it on tape, that he very much intended for Soul Car to be the name. They talk about the Vulcan Ambassador, and there's another show where they talk about, well, they didn't exactly chase the Vulcan Ambassador with pitchforks when he landed on Earth. That Soul Car is meant to be the Vulcan that gets off the T'Plana Hoth first contact Vulcan with Zeph from Cochrane. Which, not only is that a cute tie-up, but it basically puts Spock and Sarek's father, like, in the driver's seat of Earth-Vulcan history. It's like they've always been tied up with Earth-Vulcan, you know, the overlapping of history. So to drop that in here and have that be another little, little ting mm-hmm. in that little chain of trivia tie-down was kind of cool.
Well, they dropped that great line. T'Pol talks about going camping, and the only time she ever has been the Kos Wan ritual, mm-hmm. which is the same one from the animated series. Yesteryear, which is such a fantastic episode. Right. So really proving mm-hmm. that TAS is canon because it's been referenced in other shows.
Yesteryear gets called back to fairly often.
Well, I was going to say, when the animated series was kind of lost in the woods because Gene had second thoughts about it, that the one show that all the writers kept going back to was Yesteryear. It was like, well, if they, you know, made an exception of the rest of the series for one thing or another. I mean, part of that was legal because of Larry Niven's Kzinti, and they got into legal things there where they couldn't actually admit that the Kzinti overlapped the Star Trek universe, and that was kind of awkward. And, you know, they're calling the first ship to have warp drive the Bonaventure, and there's, you know, the goofy force field belts and all that stuff in the animated. But Yesteryear was not just the fact that it was written by Dorothy Fontana herself, but it was just such a great... It could have been expanded into a dramatic 1 hour very easily and not, you know, and been a great thing. And it's all Vulcan-centric. So, yeah, so.
While we're talking about Soul Car here and the crossword puzzle, and he was supposed to be the Vulcan that got off the ship in First Contact, they should have had the line where she then asks the crewwoman asks the captain for the crossing word. Because, you know, in crossword puzzles, how they have the clues down and across mm-hmm. and they'll somehow relate to each other. What was the name of Soul Car's hit song on Vulcan? 12 letters, and it crosses the word. Ooby Dooby, of course.
Oh, right, okay. I was going, Chris, you better have an ending for this. Yeah, right.
Because Soul Car was there. He was dancing to Ooby Dooby with Zephram.
I just wondered if by like 200 years went by and it's Spock's generation, if his grandfather had been that, or his great grandfather had been that intelligent and went into heavy industry, that you would think everybody on Vulcan would be driving Soul Cars by then. But you know.
Oh goodness.
Okay, sorry. Bring it to a halt. While we're on this vein of goofy things, they talk about the T'Plana being the ship that had been hit by a neutronic mm-hmm. wave, and then Archer comes back and yells at her because she'd soft-pedaled it. He's like, they didn't barely get out of it. They got squashed. And why didn't you be honest with me? They were actually going to say the T'Plana Hoth there, and they shortened it. Mike intended that to be, which is the retconned word for the lander in First Contact, which they took it then from the Vulcan matriarch of philosophy from Star Trek III. And mm-hmm. I'm glad that they cut it because it would kind of have been a bummer if Soul Car's ship that made first contact with Earth wound up being, you know, a doomed ship later on. So I'm a little tiny footnote here. That's a cool piece of trivia to know and an evolution, you know, a road not taken thing. But that's mm-hmm. one that I'm glad they didn't do because and I can see why they didn't.
Yeah, a lot of times it's better to leave out those details, right? Leave something to the viewer to just imagine instead of trying to fill in all the blanks.
Well, I mean, it's nice texture, but do we have to make the Vulcan landing ship a historic thing, like doomed?
Right.
You know, could we just like make it another ship and all that? So
yeah.
Anyway, another cute, cool little nitty thing.
That also sounds a bit like DePaul is, like if you read fairy tales to your children these mm-hmm. days, you know, Brothers Grimm and such, the endings and the stories have really been changed to soften them up.
They've been vanillaed?
Yes.
Yeah, vanilla. Yeah. They've been vanillaed. So, but Matthew, talking about everyone, while we're talking about people in close quarters here, you and I were also talking about the scene where T'Pol and Archer are sitting there and disturbing each other as they're going to try to get some rest. And there's some great moments in the episode between the two of them.
Yeah, I love that, they had kind of had a little bit, I guess, of sexual tension at the beginning of the show, and a lot of people kind of read it that way. But I like this episode because it's more of seeing her still trying to get used to this whole idea. When you think back to what they've talked about with T'Pol, the fact that she's very sensitive to smell, and the fact that all of these people have not taken a shower for days now. You know, Archer's have his dog there that he's playing with. all of this together, you can tell that she's probably having a very tough time dealing with this in the first place.
Oh yeah,
and they remind me a lot of the Odd Couple, basically. Just, you know, they're both doing things that are annoying to each other, and mm-hmm. just their banter back and forth, they create a really nice. And by this point, I feel like they've created a really nice friendship between those two. And you have some great callbacks, Archer watching water polo on his pad there, which it's funny, his pad can do a trillion times more things, apparently, than Picard's pads, because he can actually watch video and then read on it, you know, as well. You know, he doesn't have to have like 12 of them.
But I was looking at his pad as he's watching the water polo match. And I was just thinking that, you know, the bevel around that screen is pretty thick. He needs to get the pad air.
Yeah, he does. he definitely didn't.
Here, I was just thinking how smart he was to download the water polo game before he had to go into flight mode.
Yeah.
You know,
hey, he's
neutronic
a smart guy.
Wave mode. Yeah, yeah. No, seriously, that just went by, and I thought, you know, when they shot this in what, 01, 02, 02, 03? Okay, so like in 02, 03. And just how normal that looks now to pick up your pad and flick it on. Yeah. And still, as late as 2002, that was still not a common thing to have a mobile device. You know, that's only been 10 years, and how much we talk about Star Trek, future Star Trek series especially, have to stay ahead of our technology level and our cultural level to be able to have some kind of sci-fi future distance and a buffer zone into the future. And it's just, I mean, there's another perfect example of how we watched that down and went, yeah, so what? Big deal. He had a pad and he had his water polo game on it. Big deal. At the time, it was just 10 years ago. That mm-hmm. was still a kind of a gee whiz thing.
It looked futuristic, right? Yeah. And now mm-hmm. it looks clunky because of the devices that we have right now. But that was a great moment. You know, am I disturbing you? Does this bother you? Only slightly.
Yeah.
And then that's what T'Pol says. And then I love when Archer comes back with her with the same response. Yeah, only slightly.
Here's an actual character thing, not a background thing, and I'll bring up with you guys. Watching that again, do you, you know, when the show launched, and I'm not sure where they thought it might head, but do you think T'Pol and her Vulcanness and as a friction point with the rest of the crew, that was an obvious dramatic plan for the format of the show and the character layout and all. But as far as like a sexual tension, did you ever really feel that they might either it might have happened on its own or that there was a plan or maybe, you know, throwing something on the wall to see what sticks, that there was ever a chance for that to really have happened with Archer? Now, I know in Twilight they play with that and a couple of other times, but, you know, eventually they wound up going with her and Trip as the sexual tension. But just watching the two, and this was obvious. This was midway second season, but I'd forgotten how much of a kind of like Terry Farrell on DS9, how much this was a model that we're going to turn into an actress kind of a situation. And I'm not knocking anybody or Terry or Jolene, but that's their background was in modeling, and they weren't primarily actresses, but they were so gorgeous that they were like, well, duh, get, you know. Go take some coaching, get on there. And I know the first year or so she had a coach with her around the studio because she was like, you know, cramming her homework to get up to snuff, so to speak. And it seemed like she was still a little hesitant and tentative here, whether that's the Vulcan-ness and that's the character or whatever. And by the third and fourth season, she seemed much more, just as an actress, much more assured.
Yeah.
But watching those scenes, that scene you were just talking about with the two of them there and having a little kind of comic thing going back and forth, do you ever get the sense that there had been planned or that that could ever evolve into a sexual tension thing? Because it doesn't seem that way to me watching that. And I know some people still yell, and there were, even as the show was on the air, there were people yelling for it to go that direction, and it was almost like Twilight was a sop to them. You know, it's not quite on the level of the Janeway Chakotay thing in Voyager, but I mean, what do you guys think?
You know, I don't, you know, oh goodness. I think
there's a curveball I'll throw you out of the blue.
I don't think so. I remember watching the show and I never really picked up on those two. I always honestly kind of picked up on pretty quickly, even in the first season, that Trip and T'Pol had a great bickering relationship that always ends up turning into something on TV. And their chemistry together, just the two actors going at each other. You'd never seen them go that place with the captain, and I didn't think they ever would, just allowing them to have a relationship with a crew member that's below them, because in the military or in any kind of organization, that's always frowned upon.
Unless she plays a roll-up keyboard.
Right, exactly.
That's right.
Sorry. Okay.
And
throw a TNG,
which takes you to another crawl space, right?
Right, exactly.
Right, there you go. Error, but, right, right.
Yes.
So I wouldn't have pictured that happening. But I do think that what they found with them is they did have a good chemistry together, and they found a great way to work that relationship between Archer and T'Pol, and their kind of cantankerousness. You know, in the first season really came more from the fact that she's challenging him and all of that. They just happen to work well together. And you know, they do play with it a little bit with that idea of Archer obviously is attracted to her in
A Night in Sickbay.
Yeah, which I think is a funny episode. And I mean, honestly, who wouldn't think about her a little bit in that way every once in a while, just because she is
a
beautiful.
Well, they all do.
Well, Reed thinks about her all the time, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, Reed,
this whole conversation about her bomb in Shuttle Pod 1.
Trip is the only one who gets to enjoy the full experience, so.
Well put, Matthew.
The full Vulcan? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the full Vulcan, yeah. So...
the full Vulky, I kind of like the combining series again there, but yeah.
For me, I think that I know.
But
fans
to quantify what I was saying, Chris, before you start, I guess watching that scene in my mind, I was like, if that was the plan, it wasn't going to happen. And for all those people, they were like, no, it should have been an Archer. Wait, what would that be? And it should have been an AT. You know, A/T. Yeah. It should have gone that way. I watched that and I go, no, guys, no.
I think that fans want that. And with Janeway and Chakotay, which you mentioned, I think there was a lot more sexual tension between the two of them than there ever was between Archer and T'Pol. But I think Archer and T'Pol, I mean, it's a nice idea in setup where you've got T'Pol who can't stand to be around humans and thinks they stink and such, and then you've got Archer who really doesn't like the Vulcans. For the two of them to come together, you could certainly go that way with the story, and they do help each other grow, but it turns out to not be that way because of the sexual tension. And I always think of the very end of These Are the Voyages when Archer is about to walk out to give his speech, and T'Pol is, you know, fixing his tie, and that to me sums up the course that their relationship took, that they have this respect for each other. They helped each other grow, but it was more in, I don't know if it's a brother or sister way, but it, you know, close colleague way, nothing that ever reached. And what they were able to achieve with Trip, that because Trip himself is kind of xenophobic, especially as the series starts out, I don't think Trip could ever imagine himself being with a Vulcan. And so they're able to take the same idea but apply it not to the captain, which, Matthew, as you were saying, is something that I also never thought they would do. but follow it effectively by having it be Trip and the Bowl.
It's something that Star Trek never did well, was relationships, except for Deep Space Nine, because they allowed their characters to actually be in relationships. So Worf and Jadzia, they have great chemistry. Mm-hmm. We put them together, you know, Ezri and Bashir at the end of the season, yeah. We put them together, you know, we give the captain a relationship because this is actual real life. You know, you meet somebody, you fall in love, you get, you know, you get in a relationship with them. You maybe get married, you break up, whatever. This is what was so frustrating about when they got to Enterprise again. And you really, they do this whole dance with these characters and, you know, obviously Trip and T'Pol are in love with each other. They're trying to figure things out. But for the fact that they never actually get together, I know it frustrated the actors because they talked about it on the Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that you know, Jolene hated the most because they just never let them go anywhere with it, really. And so for fans, it's frustrating because, you know, as a fan of something, you end up shipping people, characters that you want to see together. And a lot of people liked them together. I personally was one of them. And the fact that they never let them go there was just annoying. You know, it's like you've put these two characters together and then you rip them apart. This isn't Ross and Rachel. This is real, you know.
And then you chalk it up to a – well, see, it's really – just sitting here and talking about this just as a personal thing. It's like Enterprise was like the baby of the shows, and it's like the baby that died prematurely. Yeah. And it's like been the one that's – it's the one that's had the least time to be – now, if you've just been a fan for 3 or 4 years, it's the wall O season boxes, like I talk about. So everything's equal. But if you've actually been along for a long time, you've had the least chance to watch Enterprise a million times, unlike mm-hmm. the original or even Next Gen or whatever. But just going back through this, to have that chalked up to it being a, you know, a drug addiction, or her, you know, having it be a pathology that she's breaking down. And it's like, no, well, what is it? And that's what she was upset about. It. Mm-hmm. That's a cheat. Yeah. Does she really have the feelings? Or are you going to chalk it up to, you know, the diseases and things that they're running around with, and drugs?
I felt like it. I think I said this on Warp 5, that the drug addiction, I think, allowed her to be looser with the emotions that she already had. Mm-hmm. So I take it as that she had the feelings. She would have kept them bottled up, but the drug addiction and the Pinar syndrome allowed her to loosen the reins on that and let it out. So I didn't really see it as much as a cheat, I think, as maybe Jolene did.
Well, and I think that they answer the question on whether or not she actually loves him, and if it has anything to do with, you know, her drug addiction, and if it's real in Home, they clearly answer the question that she is in love with him, and that he is in love with her. Mm-hmm. And it had nothing. It may have been helped on the fact that she was able to loosen up because of her drug addiction, or because maybe it's broken down some walls that she can't build up anymore. And so she's become a little bit, you know, more human. But they definitely answer that question, I think, in that episode. And it's probably one of the reasons I liked mm-hmm. it the most, is because they finally dealt with the question, what are you going to do with these characters that obviously love each other? And they wrote something, and obviously Enterprise gets cut down and Trip dies stupidly because it's the worst episode ever.
But Matthew,
except for the crowd scene, except for the audience.
Exactly.
Scene,
you're right. Except for the,
that was an amazing scene. Wow.
That's where the camera just goes right to Larry on that scene, right?
It's the only thing about that last episode that's just cut out that 10 seconds. And, And let her straighten the tie. Yeah.
Yeah. But Matthew, talk about the writing, though. The one thing about it, I mean, they do beat around the bush for a long time, but at the same time, like, you don't want it to be too easy for the first Vulcan couple to come together. So the fact that they did drag it out is, in that respect, good, because if they had just, oh, yes, I love you, Trip, I love you, T'Pol, and then they're together, it would just feel a little bit...
Let's rub fingers.
Yeah, well, and I have no problem, like you said. I think that's perfect. You need to make this the hardest thing ever, because it would be the first time these two species have done this. Right. And so I think that makes complete sense. The fact that they never give them a definitive, let's go for it, let's have them be the first, let's show the first, you know, relationship between Vulcans and humans, which would have been fantastic, which would have set up the fact that you have Spock as parents the same right. way. Maybe have them struggle having kids or something. I mean, because, you know, that makes Spock special still, that they can't have kids, you know, or something.
I was going to say that. The only downside about the whole T'Pol trip thing, if you really want to get that way, is it takes away a little bit from Sarek and Amanda.
Yeah.
Just a touch.
Yeah.
But it's like one of those millions of things is, geez, they've known – by Kirk's time and Spock's time, they've known – the Vulcans and humans have been joined at the hip for 200 years, and we're only now finding out about, you know, Plak Tow, and we're only now finding out about some of these things. So
right. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is something that we could pull out of Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight, which is that if Enterprise had continued on 5th, 6th, 7th season, maybe they could have shown how that relationship didn't work out. And so then what mm-hmm. Sarek and Amanda had still was special and still mm-hmm. was a breakthrough, because it almost happened before, yeah. but it didn't.
Well, and even the fact
work.
Of late in the season, spoiler alert, that their baby doesn't make it. Is kind right. of a setup to preserve the Spock.
Is a setup
and,
for that.
And right. the thing that I always appreciate, one of the, you know, it's kind of like, why does every alien have to have a bumpy forehead, you know, whatever. Well, it's human TV, American TV production, in pre-CGI era mostly. But the whole thing about, geez, it takes my old thing about the Universal Galactic Docking Collar, how any two ships can come in and dock with each
right.
other or go to each other's yeah. space stations when they come with totally different colors. And even, I think even more of a docking dilemma is how everybody can mate with each other. And we've got half human Klingons, and we've got half human Vulcans, and we've got, you know, all these species mm-hmm. in our, you know, we've got the Romulan Simon Tarsis. I saw him on a show the other night, that actor. You know, he's like 1/8 Romulan or whatever. And there was that album that came out. Now it's been re-released as a CD. But the original Inside Star Trek album that Roddenberry did with Shatner and mm-hmm. not with Leonard, but with right. Or Mark Leonard and not Leonard Nimoy. But they go through – it's like Gene talking to Mark Leonard in character as Sarek. And they actually – and I've used this to talk to fans, explain it. It's like, well, no. This is like hindsight. This is like the first wave of retconning in the late 70s. And how they talk about how it was a huge medical thing for a human and a Vulcan to, and how Amanda's, you know, womb and fetus were like guarded, not guarded, were, you know, like TLC'd to death, and how they, some of it was in vitro and out, and Vulcan terms of pregnancy are longer than humans and,
mm-hmm.
and all that. But they made an attempt to say, and I'm like, hey, it's Gene and Mark Leonard talking on an album that they sanctioned, so it's canon to me, and I would use that for.
Yeah. Well, and I think
in a way this still preserves that.
That really, again, you give Enterprise 7 seasons and you can explore that. You know, mm-hmm. you could have really gotten into that whole idea, and that maybe at this point Trip and T'Pol cannot have children, and because they haven't gotten to the point medically to figure that out. And again, you just deal with that issue, and it creates for a great continuity thing of it. Again, it makes and preserves Spock and his parents as being very special. And you know, you don't take anything away from that. You know, you just kind of create a building block then. And so, which is, you know, one of the things that when Enterprise really is firing on all cylinders, it does. It creates those great building blocks to get to, you know, what you see in TOS. And so, well, Chris, one of the other things that we were kind of talking about, what we would want to talk about, and I think that we mentioned already, this episode on Blu-ray looks brilliant. I mean, just...
Yeah, it really, really does.
Just fantastic. I was watching really closely because I was looking for scenes where I thought, oh, the upgrade doesn't work well or any of those kind of things. And I just felt like there's nothing about this episode that feels cheesy or like, oh, that CGI is not great. This is good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. The storm, the ship going through the storm. It's, I'm not going to say it is the most beautiful, best CGI of any episode of Star Trek, because I'd have to go back through and watch to be sure that's my feeling. But it's definitely right up there at the top of just some of the most impactful scenes where you really feel like you're in space with the ship and the way with the CG, you know, and I love the physical models as well, but they do mm-hmm. some things just like we see in one of the other good things about These Are the Voyages is the fact that they do have those scenes with the CG 1701D going through the asteroid field and the scenes from the Pegasus. And you just think about how dynamic the Next Generation would have been if they could have done scenes like that in many other episodes, the way they do here on Enterprise in this episode, because, boy, I just tell you, the ship going through the storm is just fantastic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was an evolution thing. I mean, it's funny to me to have to go back and write for so long. It was, here's motion control, here's the way we shoot, here's what we, oh, and this new CGI thing. And for a long time, like in the 90s when Babylon 5 was trying to, and Foundation Imaging was trying to pioneer CGI on a TV level, which if you're doing a feature, you, not only do you have a lot more money, but you have the time. But when you're no amount of money in the world in a budget is going to invent, you know, is going to clone time so that your guys can render and do all this stuff, much less have the technology there, especially like the, I remember them talking about how the particle, it was one thing to do a hard surface like ship, but when you got into fire and plasma and particle-y kind of things, the CG was not there, and it was hard enough to do it on a feature level, much less do it on a TV level without it looking, they used to talk about it, it looks CG-ish, you know, and oh, we don't want to do it. Babylon 5 is trying to pioneer it, and that's fine, but Star Trek can't do that because people expect more out of it, and it looks all CGE, CGE, and you know, Voyager that started to turn, and even Gary Hutzel on DS9 the last year, they went in, he's like, you know, I'll do it when it makes sense and all that, and Voyager midway through, they went to more CG, and it just, they just had to wait for the technology and the budget to do it, to turn around, and so by the time Enterprise, well, the ship itself is the first non-hero built, model built ship, you know, there was never a physical model of the NX-01. So talking about these waveforms and these particle physics and the particle bit, it's the technology is just now getting there. And, of course, we sit around now and people do CG fan films on their laptops in 5 minutes now, and it's no big deal. But to put this back in historical context and think about where they were, it was kind of amazing. And how they would have loved to have had that, because in the old days when they would do waves and things, they would get – like liquid oxygen, liquid nitrogen on a black, you know, velvet and shoot it black and white. And different angles and get it to behave differently and do things and then go in and color tint it.
That's how they did the Badlands in For the Uniform when they redid the Badlands, because they didn't like the ones from Caretaker.
Right. They the CG'd ones from Caretaker that they were like, oh, look, we're doing CG. It sure looks like it. In 1994.
Yes, you are.
And yes, you are. And, you know, but that's Gary Hutzel on DS9 going, okay, I want CGI to happen, but I'll have it when it doesn't look like crap on our time and budget. So he was a last holdout on that. But
which is basically how I feel about the entire series of Babylon 5. It's great that you're trying to do CG, but it's just visually not working at this point in time.
Yeah, go back and watch. Oh, good grief! What was the movie of the kid that was The Last Starfighter? That was the first movie to have hardcore CGI ships, and they spent. And it was the big deal, and those ships do have that CGE look.
Well,
CG-ish.
Yeah. Even today, they're doing that with Once Upon a Time, where the whole show is pretty much CG. You know, all the sets are CG because they're in all these fantastic wars, and I stopped honestly watching the show because the CG pulls me out every time because it's so bad. I mean, I can tell, you know, people still get upset, you know, with somebody like George Lucas doing all these CGI sets and like the prequels, and that's top of the line CG, still looks fantastic most of the time, and people still complain about that. So, you know, a whole TV show based around this, you know, to me, you know, whatever you're doing visually, whether it's, you know, an effect or something, it needs to serve the story, but it also needs to work well enough to not pull people out. And so the fact that these visual effects, I'm watching them on Blu-ray, they're not made for this yet at this point, and they still look fantastic. This is great work. It was showing that they were doing the very best work they possibly could, and it really pays off when you're watching it now. And I think this episode looks better than half the things I see on TV in our day and age. So,
Well, that are made today,
you know, Dan Curry was the visual effects producer, and I was just looking at some notes. I didn't have it transcribed, but I know I wish I'd had him talking. But Ron B. Moore, who'd been around since day one and worked with Dan from the beginning of Next Gen, he was the supervisor for this show. And, you know, they talk about, you know, Star Trek continues and people and the fan films, and people say, I don't get why these professionals want to work on these fan films, and how do they get people to do all this for free or for their expenses? They were sitting here thinking about this every time a Star Trek would go out. Sometimes it would be, and this was the CGI guys, because almost anybody in CGI in the visual effects is a fanboy themselves, more so than maybe the other Hollywood guilds and things. But you had that especially with visual effects. It's the coolest thing, and it's visual and art people. And if you're working in visual effects in Hollywood for 20 years in CG, meant you sci-fi. Now it's like, oh, you know, medical procedurals, and they're tracking down the red blood being toxified in somebody's bloodstream, and it's room. And there's more CGI in that 10 seconds than used to be in a whole season of Next Generation or something. But back when the shows were running, they took advantage of – not took advantage, but it was there. And when you say like a Foundation or Eden Effects or whoever the house was, the TV shows, you would have them putting – you're talking about how great it looked. You would have guys like, if not an actual – you know, oh, we'll throw that in. Or even in the physical days, Greg Jean and the model makers and those guys, oh, here's a couple of – I'll build a couple models extra for the price. This episode, you can't cheap this out, because the producers are looking at budgets and numbers, and they're going, we can't afford this. We got your price listing. We can't afford it. You've got to cut a ship. And everybody in the art department, visual effects, goes, no, you have to show this. You have to do – and it's like, okay, fine. Here, I'll do this, and 2 years from now, you can pay me for it on another show later on. You know, I mean, they would fan film it. They would go the extra mile, even though it wasn't, you know, in their own best interest. They weren't getting paid all the way. Or if it wasn't an actual physical thing, they would come back and do two extra passes and just put in the time and labor, you know, and do it. And all those guys, and nobody was holding a face pistol to their head. I mean, they were all doing it because they had the pride in their work. Not that any of the other divisions didn't, but it was Star Trek, and they were all fanboys and geek out guys, and they had the early power in their hands to do it. And they also knew, more so than other, you know, people in props or costumes or whatever, that people were going to be watching this for 40 years, and whatever they took the time. So what if I only got 2 hours of sleep last night in the crunch of this? This is going to be analyzed under a microscope for 40 years, and they got that better than even some of the other departments. Even after 10, 15, 20 years of Star Trek and knowing that's, you know, but and coming out of the videotape age into DVDs, and now we're talking about HD, you know, micro scrutiny. And what, you know, by the time these are all transferred to hollow, you know, purple ray, whatever, down the line, three-dimensional things, and scrutinizing. But those guys, they would, so when you talk about, I can't imagine how, I mean, this, the CGI and this looks incredible. All those kinds of things more and more piled up, and by the time of Enterprise even, guys were putting in – and girls were putting in extra time and extra things, and whether it was on the vendor level or it was the individual CG artist sitting at their poor monitors for, you know, 27 hours a day, working Bajoran time or whatever, you know, they were doing that. And it's because it was Star Trek, and they took pride in it, and they knew that it would be – it would, you know. What's my little lack of sleep tonight compared to 50 years of fans looking at this scene for ages? Which is another cool – so then when you look at the fan films and you go, how are they doing? They were doing it on the paid shows. People were going above and beyond, you know. So it's always – it's Star Trek. It's those two magic words. What can I say?
No, it's excellent. That's how creatives are. I think that's how some of us who are creative professionals have – sometimes we have trouble making as much money as maybe we would like to, because we are willing – I think by nature to make that concession where like, okay, you don't have any money. Well, I'm still going to do it anyway, because it's important creatively to do it.
Pay no attention to that guy in the corner going, sucker.
Right. Exactly. Well, Larry, one last thing that I want to ask you about, because you mentioned it earlier and it intrigued me. And I was going to slip it in when we were talking about T'Pol sitting there watching Archer have Porthos in his face. You said at the beginning that you have some notes about Porthos, and I was just curious.
Oh yeah, I was going to say it was just the fact that Wendy was, I mean, Breezy was the main dog by now. This is second season. But this was a really – his trainer, Scott Rowe, was talking about in the interview I did with him back in the day how this was a hard show because normally when they had Porthos, it was Scott and Porthos working and maybe one other character or two other characters. And these – if you watch how Porthos was in this show, they kind of had him in the quarters with Scott, and I watched most of the show. I didn't see the last nth degree of it. But most of the time they would do stuff with him like peeking out of a bulkhead and all that. Mm-hmm. Basically, that they ran into problems just having so many bodies in that crammed catwalk. Said it was great for the tension in the story, whatever. But it was really hard for him to concentrate and do what he was supposed to do with his training when there were so many bodies and so many distractions, and it was so claustrophobic.
I can see that.
And so when the things they got him to do with that much, they would. If you notice, when you see Porthos in this, they cheat a little bit, and it's an inset. And there's not really that many million people in camera with him. So, and a couple of times they'd be doing a scene in this one and he's supposed to be walking with him and they were doing a master and they get to the end of the thing and go, oh, where's Breezy? And he's like, oh, he's over on stage 9. Oh, okay. What happened? Handler lost him in the feet there, kind of a thing.
But he's getting ready for the pilot of his own show over there on stage 9.
Now, I know, and while I found some notes here, I know Mike Sussman has talked on audio commentaries and some things there. So I don't know if this is, but I found a couple of comments he made on the story evolution of this. He was talking about how originally they were going to have it be an Ion Storm and kind of be a pre-homage to Kirk and Finney and Court Martial. And then they decided, but apparently, and I was trying to remember this, there was a reference to an Ion Storm in Nemesis, and this was all at the same – this was being filmed at the same time Nemesis was being released. So anyway, they said, so here's that arbitrary producer mentality out of the Cooper building where they said, we just mentioned an Ion Storm in the feature, so let's make it something else. Okay, we'll have it be a neutronic wavefront. And Mike said, I'm just quoting here. He says, what I liked about it was we see 100 years in the future how Captain Kirk handles an Ion Storm. You send a guy into the pod and you fly through it at warp 8. Well, in this era, it's very different. You don't have shields, which is kind of what we mentioned. You don't have shields. You have to shut everything down. You crawl in your radiation tube and you wait it out. It's a very prickly way to do with it. He said it was a bottle show and it turned out to be very expensive. I didn't think it was the most ambitious show we did all year at all. But for a romp and a storm, it was a lot of fun. It showed Archer and his crew dealing with things in a much different way than Kirk or Picard or Janeway or Sisko would. He said they would just throw up the shields and count down the percentages. Shields to 80, down to 70, down to 60, we better get out of here. And he was just saying that he thought that was a very rough back to the submarine-y type of that. But I liked the percentages. Talk about technobabble, that was even more basic. And they didn't. They didn't just count down the percentages. It was...
Yeah, what I liked, I mean,
as we said, yeah,
the beginning of the episode, the aliens that come aboard, they're like, you would go to warp 7 now, and they're like, oh yes. Crap, we only go to warp 5, and so there's just that big long pause of bum bum bum, and so the whole playing with the fact that even our ship can't go as fast as those other ships, which they wouldn't be in any danger, they'd just warp out of danger. And then that this is much more, we just don't have all that stuff. So we got to make do with what we got. And if we want to live, we all get in this crawl space for, over a week. It makes for just a great show because again, you're talking about things that can't happen on a Voyager, Deep Space Nine, TNG, all that kind of stuff. You're giving us something that can only happen on Enterprise, and that's what we want to see when we're watching Enterprise. I don't want to just watch a show that I feel like can happen on any of the other shows. Show me something I haven't seen before, and this was one of those things. I really enjoyed it.
Make the format work for you. I think this was all just a totally for the purist. Evan English was one of the regular stand-ins, as they did in all the series, and if you were around long enough, they would just use you on camera as well as being a stand-in since you had a uniform on anyway. And if you were really a good stand-in and they liked you and they kept you around long enough, your walk-on role, your little extra in the corners that they liked to have to make it feel like it was a regular crew if you saw faces, even if they were non-talking faces, famously. And he got named Tanner in this – he became Ensign Tanner in this show. They say the backup, and he was the backup helmsman for that. Which, total trivia, John Sheban, who worked on The X-Files, was a writer-producer this 1 year, second season, and Tanner was his wife's maiden name, and he wasn't even a writer on this episode. So there you go. There's your ultimate be a killer at the water cooler at your next con trivia for people. There you go.
I was thinking that, you know, they were just fans of Alf, and that was Ensign Willie Tanner who was there on the Enterprise.
I hate to blow it up for you, Chris, but...
All right. Well, we've been talking for over an hour about this episode, so why don't we wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings. And Matthew, what are your final thoughts here on the catwalk?
You know, Chris, I think this is one of those episodes when you watch it back that you, I think, like even more. I mean, I've always enjoyed this episode, but every time I watch it, I just reminded of all the good things that happened in this episode. That there's great writing, great character moments, excellent use of the setting that you've created with Enterprise. And so all of those things work in concert really well and just create a fantastic episode. And so, you know, to see if I was going to give this a rating, I'd probably give this 9 out of 10 smelly uniforms.
Wow. Is that a good rating?
Smelly yeah, uniforms? It is. Yeah. So, okay. And we didn't even talk about the great, you know, character moment at the end, you know, where T'Pol is watching movie night, you know, and she's yeah. explaining to them what right. happened, yes. you know, and she had picked up on, obviously, being Vulcan, that they kind of missed. And so I love, you know, there's that great character moment there at the very end of the episode. So, this is a fantastic episode.
How about you, Larry?
And that it was a great character moment, and we kind of didn't get back to that. I should mention real fast too, if there's a couple of the Tacrets, the Tacret captain that's boarding, is a actor named Danny Goldring, and he'd been in a lot of treks over the years, and probably the thing he gets because he got to be a human with redder hair, not quite as grayed maybe. He was Chief Burke in Nor the Battle to the Strong, that's trapped. In the trench
with Jake,
yeah. Sisko, mm-hmm. and he's yeah. talking about life and yeah, and he was a Hirogen on Voyager. He was a Nazi, a gamer Hirogen, and he was a Noskin on an Enterprise. But anyway, so you know, again, they're reusing cast and all that. But no, this is a show, and I was watching the beginning too, and just it reminded me how dynamic. It's like by the third show, the fourth show, they had really learned how much bang for the buck they were getting out of things, whether it was the show of the week or what they put into the sets originally. And just the opening sequence when they think they're going to go down and have this happy-dappy planet survey, and they're all happy talking, and they've got both shuttle pods dressed out and then the shuttle pod bay. And the fluid, the camera is very dynamic, and they're tracking everybody along the stairwells and using all the doors and the pods, and they're open and they're in and out. And it's really cool. They would have killed to have been able to do that on Next Generation. But here they had built those sets and those pods and the doors and hatches, and they were able to get in and out very quickly. Mike Vihar was the director, and you know, kudos to him. And it's Herman's sets and all that. And it just reminded me, for all the kicking that, you know, people kick Enterprise being down, how much they had learned over the years and applied and had, you know, built into the sets and the way they shot the shows. And anyway, it was sad. It was sad that it didn't have more than the thing. But anyway, because there are some cute things in Catwalk, I'll give it 8 white chef's boots.
Ooh, nice.
Woohoo, nice.
Well, yeah, I love the premise of this episode as well, and the character moments. And one thing we didn't talk about was the poker game. And mm-hmm. this episode, mm-hmm. being in the close quarters and seeing the catwalk and the way the set design and all was done, this episode, possibly more than any other Star Trek episode for me, reminds me a lot of Battlestar Galactica.
So say we all.
It had a lot of like a BSG feel, especially early, the remade Battlestar Galactica that Ronald D. Moore did. Early episodes, I think even in the miniseries, where they're having the poker games, it had a lot of that feel to it, although, you know, no one punched each other out. But it just had that feeling, which was nice. And we didn't get to talk about the tailgating that was going on, because I love it when they smell something and they go back and they pull the curtain and those aliens are grilling sausage on the ship.
Yes.
So
to me, it was more like going down to steerage in the bottom of Titanic, you know, and it's like, what are those people doing that? What are you doing in your dorm room in there? You can't have an electric skillet in your suite mate's bathroom.
You got to turn that thing off. Yeah. That was a great moment, but it's a really nice episode, and there's so much more to talk about that we didn't even touch on here. But I'm going to give this episode a royal flush, which actually gets you Hoshi's last pack of dessert rations, I believe.
Excellent. Yeah.
Did you notice that, speaking of the poker game, Malcolm was playing with one of the things he gave up to bet with was pineapple cobbler?
Oh, that's right, because he's allergic to pineapple, right?
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. It was kind of a cute little – I thought that was – there you go, Mike Sussman. Always dragging on the fanboy stuff there. Okay.
That's really nice. Like, this is the one thing I can't eat anyway, so I'm going to bet this.
Yeah.
Very nice. All right. Well, Larry, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you and, you know, find out about everything that's going on.
LarryNemechek.com, TreklandBlog.com. We're ramping up for the Geek Nation Tours Trek to Vegas tour next summer, and Star Trek continues. We just filmed, and a new episode will be out in March-ish, I think, and we're going to shoot a third one in February, thanks in large part to the Kirkstarter that we just had. And if anybody was a donor, thank you for jumping in. And they're still going to keep putting bloopers and clips and things up on our Facebook page for Star Trek Continues, official Star Trek Continues. So my Trekland on Speaker CDs are out that Chris, you helped me with, produce. And all that stuff. Twitter, Larry Nemechek, at Larry Nemechek on Twitter, and my Larry Nemechek Trekland on Facebook.
Very good. Lots of places to find Larry. So many things going on all the time, right?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go up and hide in the catwalk, I think, to take a break.
That's the only way you can get any peace, right?
So you take along all my crossword pads with me and have something to do, yeah.
And your water polo matches. Does Oklahoma have a good water polo team?
Oh, they might. I don't know.
I don't know about that. All right. Well, thanks again, Larry.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Chris, that was really fun to get a chance to talk to Larry about Catwalk, and just I always love when we have Larry on because you never know what kind of background information he's going to have. I mean, he even has information on Porthos, and so that's how extensive Dr. Trek's knowledge is of Star Trek. So it's so much fun to be able to have him on the show.
Yeah, especially fun with Enterprise because, as I was saying during the show, the things he knows haven't been transcribed yet to Memory Alpha and places. And so you do get a lot of interesting little behind the scenes tidbits that you didn't know before. So that is always fun. But, you know, it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Gene Roddenberry.
I appreciate Gene Roddenberry as a creator because he had a vision and he stuck to it, unlike other creators of other franchises that we won't get into.
Who are you talking about, Drew?
Not George Lucas.
Earl Grey.
Romance on TNG.
I got the four pips. I'm ready to settle down now. It wasn't until then that I could get stay with one woman.
So instead of rings, do they use that last pip on his collar as the signal of their eternal love and devotion together?
The orb.
Bajoran prophecies.
Well, you know, I was thinking that Horan was probably not so much a prophet as a Bajoran songwriter who just wrote really bad lyrics.
The ready room.
Faces.
What you brought up is the exact reason why I like this episode so much, because the essential message is we have to have our good and our not so hot qualities to make us who we are. We have to deal with them. And this is just a very extreme version of that.
To the journey!
Workforce rewrite.
And I'm totally with you about Jaffin. He is like Mark version 2.0. He's just like, he's a little too laid back. He's a little too quick to buy into all of this. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, dude, grow a pair. I like the way you put that.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Black and Cushman, Part 2.
So they were trying to find a replacement, not to play Spock, but to play another Vulcan who would be assigned to the Enterprise.
Whoa.
And one of the one of the guys they were considering was David Carradine, who went on
what?
To play.
Oh, my
God.
Warp 5.
Continuity and Consequences.
It was a place that you generally don't expect Star Trek to go with a major character for sure, and certainly not for the period of time that it went on, because, you know, it starts in Fusion. She becomes infected with this Pinar syndrome, and then that even leads her to drug addiction.
Trek News and Views.
Looking back at TNB.
Oh, okay, we're still talking TMP. I was thinking Janeway's Pink Nighty.
I know, it's like, what?
Oh, Janeway's Pink Nighty, OBQ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You seem to like it.
Yeah, done before, yeah. Yeah. That was a nice night, though.
Literary Treks.
Bill Wynn.
It has two sides to it. You know, you can read it as just the fun yacht race, which I thought, the Federation has a biannual sailing competition? I did not know this.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can download or stream from the website. Many, many ways for you to get the shows, so check all of those out and find out what we have to say about all the corners of the Star Trek universe. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, there are a number of ways you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website. You'll see a tab there that lets you use your webcam's microphone for that. And also you can talk to other listeners in our forums at trek.fm/forums. And in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. And also, don't forget questions from the fleet. We answered two of them in today's show. And if you have questions about Star Trek that you'd like us to answer here on the Ready Room, just go to trek.fm/contact, choose questions from the fleet as the submission option, and send us your questions, and we'll be happy to answer them here on the show. Now, Matthew, when you're not hiding up in the catwalk, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm talking about all sorts of different things there, of course. And then we also do a few shows together, Chris. We do Literary Treks about books and comics. And then we also do The Orb, talking about Deep Space Nine. And so you can find me in either of those places as well. And then I do write the book reviews here on Trek FM. Now, Chris, when you're not trying some, you know, some alien cuisine or enjoying one of Chef's fantastic salads, where can we find you?
Well, I usually hang out on Twitter, you know, when I'm not eating the space food. And my username there is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username and also on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then on the network, Matthew, besides doing Literary Treks and The Orb with you, I have an interview show called Matter Stream, which we talked about at the beginning of the show today, so you can check that out. And if you enjoyed today's discussion about Enterprise, catch me over on Warp 5 with Kate Walsh, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise every week. And we've interviewed a lot of those involved in making Enterprise as well, including Brandon Braga over there on that show, so check that out. Also, Matthew, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to support our sponsors for this week's show. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, or an online store with the incredible commerce feature that we talked about in news today. Create your own space today. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial, and then use offer code TREK11 to save 10%. And don't forget to choose the annual plan to get the free custom domain registration as well. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of the Ready Room. And also, there's Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion. You can find out more about this Star Trek comm badge-like device and support their Kickstarter campaign by going to zoe.me/trekafilm. That's xowi.me/trekafilm. And remember to include the Trekafilm portion of the URL when you visit so that Zoe knows you heard about it here on the Ready Room. And we really thank Zoe for their support as well. We'd also like to introduce a new sponsor on The Ready Room, and this is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. So from classics to current bestsellers, and even some of the most famous Star Trek books, Matthew, like Prime Directive, Federation, or Spock's World. And I'm telling you, we've got to do both Prime Directive and Federation on Literary Treks.
Yes, sometimes, we do.
Because they're two of my favorite books. So you can find those if you want to get set for our discussion of those on Literary Treks. You can get them in audio format over at Audible. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Go grab Federation, Prime Directive, or any of the many, many other great classic Star Trek novels that they have on there. And you can do that at audibletrial.com/trekfm. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for their support of The Ready Room and the network. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep The Ready Room coming to you each week, and that is by adopting some aliens, but not the kind of aliens that took over the ship here in the catwalk. These are original illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. They're available as both badges and art prints, and there are different contribution levels you can choose from, so just let us know which aliens you would like and in which format, and we'll get those right over to you. Again, you'll find those at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. All right, Matthew, I've got to run. I'm really sorry. I've got to go over and see if I can find one of Tripp's converted storage units.
Well, Chris, that sounds like a great idea. And I think it's time to stick some alien barbecue in it, because the Ready Room is done.
I want to really delve deeply into Loeffler's Laws. I want to create the most informative place on the web for you to find out just how Loeffler would run your life.
Chris, goodness, wow. Is that going to be a adult-only site, or...
I think I'll have to cut this out of the spot here, Matthew.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. Yes. I didn't even think about that.